By God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies, and still this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are they waiting for?
Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John! Sit down! Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John! Sit down!
Someone ought to open up a window!
1776 debuted on Broadway in 1969, just as Richard Nixon was taking up residence in the White House. The show won a Tony for Best Musical that year, beating out the hippie romp Hair, despite two astonishing facts. There is a 30-minute stretch in the first act where no one sings a note, and it is a musical about the Declaration of Independence. These Broadway versions of the founders, plucked from their solemn poses in John Trumbull's famous portrait and forced to tread the boards, are fractious ideologues floundering in a fudged timeline as they squabble their way through the summer of 1776 at Philadelphia's Continental Congress. The crusading John Adams, Sherman Edwards' lyrics remind us over and over, is obnoxious and disliked. A gloomy General George Washington sends dispatches from the front, whining in rhyme, "Is anybody there? Does anybody care?" Accusations of treason swarm like the flies John Hancock can't shut up about, and everyone complains about the heat. The final vote for independence is an act of cowardice in this show, not bravery, by a composite character who simply doesn't want to be remembered as the guy who put the kibosh on American freedom from British rule. The idea that a bunch of vain, self-obsessed, and frequently racist jerks, as they're portrayed in the musical, could manage to forge a great nation grounded in a sincere, shared belief in liberty must have been appealing to an American public stunned in the aftermath of the 1968 election in which Alabama segregationist George Wallace took 13.5% of the vote while Nixon squeaked into office with 43.4%. Such a message might seem eternal, but the show's positive reception has yet to be duplicated in the post-Watergate era. The film's producer, Jack L. Warner, was a friend of Nixon and had testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1947, naming a dozen screenwriters as communists. After the musical hit the big time, the White House requested a special showing, only to demand the removal of that right-wing minuet that was titled "Cool, Cool, Considerate Men," in which a conservative faction vows to dance only to the right, ever to the right, never to the left, forever to the right. Those White House demands resurfaced when the film was in post-production and Warner killed the song. It was restored in later Laserdisc, VHS, and DVD releases. But by the time the movie came out, America was in no mood for a lighthearted romp through American history. Burr, Gore Vidal's 1973 runaway bestseller, offered a vision of Jefferson, Adams, Hamilton, and their ilk as hypocritical schemers, more in line with the mood of a nation about to face up to the realities of Watergate. The show that took the Tony 3 years before couldn't even manage a Golden Globe, losing to Cabaret. Words of Catherine Mangu Ward in Reason. This is an essay that reminds us that a work of art like this can reflect not only the time in which the story is set, but also the time in which it is written, and ultimately the time in which it is presented to the public. In 1969, when 1776, the musical, had its debut, the United States was, as we heard, in a political turmoil of its own. And we know well that when Abraham Lincoln stood at the battlefield at Gettysburg 67 years after that landmark summer of 1776, he addressed a country that was violently torn apart. Ronald White Jr. reminds us that Lincoln had been elected with less than 40% of the popular vote. As he prepared to speak from the east front of the Capitol in 1861 to deliver his first inaugural address, 7 southern states had already seceded from the Union. On March 4th, he spoke these words to the deeply divided nation. The mystic chords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every heart and hearthstone all over this land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as they surely will be, by the better angels of our nature. That, from an essay titled Honest Abe, reminds us of the power of words by Ronald C. White, Jr. in March 2011 on NPR. Finding the better angels of our nature is the theme of a conference this month at Keystone College in La Plume with, as it happens, a veteran journalist from NPR as a keynote speaker. The gathering, an annual three-day symposium on creativity and imagination, will explore ways of finding common ground among bitter rivals with the aim of finding ways to restore respect and acceptance among citizens and to reconnect with the best ideals of the country, the better angels of our nature. NPR's Mara Liasson will speak on Friday evening, July 14th, and author Stephen McIntosh will speak that afternoon. He is president of the Institute for Cultural Evolution. His work explores the intersection of social development, spirituality, and politics. And we had a chance to speak with him by phone about his presentation titled Growing Out of America's Divided Culture, Reclaiming Solidarity Through a More Sophisticated Understanding of Progress. We began by talking about the way he first came to his insights.
My work focuses on the evolution of values. And I've come to this field, if you will, because from an early age, I was very drawn to periods of history that experienced a kind of a renaissance or a cultural florescence. Right? I was born in 1960, so I was too young to really participate in the 1960s kind of mini renaissance. But ever since then, I thought maybe there'll be another florescence of culture, or another emergence of a new set of values that I can participate in. And so I studied history, you know, all the way back to ancient history, where there have been a whole series of different periods of cultural fluorescence in different parts of the world at different times in history. And through that, I was led to the work of those who focused on the evolution of culture and consciousness, like Teilhard de Chardin and Alfred North Whitehead and Ken Wilber and many other writers now who are trying to envision how we can take the next step of cultural maturity as a society to help us overcome the pressing problems we face, and one of which is the deep division in American society, which I think is one of the main focuses of this gathering symposium.
And it sounds like your work could, in fact, take us beyond. He said no, she said no, they said. You're getting to the fundament.
Sure. I mean, we see the divided body politic that plagues our democracy at this point as being a kind of a cultural problem that's really upstream from Washington, D.C. You know, for many years, the narrative was that hyperpartisan polarization is the result of politicians behaving badly, right? That the country itself was far less polarized than the Washington establishment. But I think after 2016, even the most ardent centrist commentators are coming around to the fact that it's a deep cultural divide that is plaguing our society at this time. But it's not simply a red-blue divide. It's oversimplifying to think of it as merely Clinton voters and Trump voters. According to our analysis, we look at culture from a variety of different angles, but one angle is a kind of a worldview angle. Worldview being defined as a sort of a historically significant set of values that persists across generations and defines what is good or true or beautiful, provides identity for people. So the mainstream worldview that, of course, most of politics occurs within is this worldview of modernity, right? The sort of the mainstream worldview of science and reason and progress. And modernity itself is a split between progressives and conservatives, but what complicates the picture and allows us to see the cultural problem more clearly is when we understand that there are two other main worldviews that are impacting our society at this point. There's, of course, the traditional worldview that is characterized by socially conservative politics, and most people can see, you know, there's modernity and then traditionalism, and they often confuse the red-blue divide as a divide being simply between social conservatives and those who are more aligned with modernity. But in the last 50 years, a third major worldview has emerged, which is sort of partially responsible for destabilizing, I think for good and bad, the cultural consensus that prevailed before 1968, right, the liberal consensus after World War II as it was known. And so the idea that we're going to go back to that consensus, or that we're going to glue the pieces back together again, I think is an old trope which many commentators, mainstream commentators, instinctively go back on when confronted with the problem of polarization. But it's one that we're trying to break out of and help people see that there's really three cultures, multiple polarities at different levels, but this complex picture doesn't make things hopelessly complex. What it does is helps us see how we can, rather than change people's values, we can try to expand the scope of what people are able to value and thereby make cultural and political progress in that way. And there's some methods that go with that.
Many of our listeners may have heard your discussion of nationalism on NPR. There's a nuance there, and what you were talking about just now, the kind of transcendence of the polarity to something wider, broader, and not just black and white.
Sure. You know, well, I'm personally a progressive person politically, and I am more of a globalist than a nationalist. But in a recent paper published on the Institute for Cultural Evolution website and featured in an NPR interview was entitled Appreciating the Upside of Nationalism. And there I argued that even though I certainly don't support Donald Trump as our nation's leader, as a advocate of democracy, in some ways I have a duty to appreciate the folk wisdom of my countrymen in terms of their, beyond any kind of Trump vote, and their deep-seated yearning to recover a degree of nationalistic solidarity. And I think there's a kernel of truth there that even us progressives need to take into account. So then I go on to argue in the paper about how really nationalism and globalism form an interdependent polarity, meaning that the continued advance of globalism, if it's to be healthy and sustainable and overall positive, depends on the vitality and health of an underlying level of nationalism, and that nationalism doesn't need to be seen as coterminous with racism or jingoism or nativism, that there's an upside, a positive feature of nationalism. And so teasing apart the dignities of patriotism and nationalism from the downsides or the disasters that go with or are often closely associated with the positives, that's a practice, a political practice for working with an indestructible, interdependent polarity, at least at this time in history, that we encounter with nationalism and globalism. I mean, in short, in order to carry forward the healthy impulses that seek to preserve some degree of national solidarity, it's really the duty of globalists, I argue, to appreciate the upside of nationalism and not let nationalism be simply characterized as an entirely negative impulse. It's going beyond kind of a relativistic respect, though. What we're advocating is that people not just respect the other side, but actually be able to look into that other side, however they constitute it or see it, and begin to kind of take on and appreciate some of the deep values, some of the really positive features of that other side, so they can come to see how deep down they value those same values, and their values depend upon the opposing values in a way. That's where this idea of value interdependence within polarities comes in. But again, it's not just a matter of relativism, of saying, okay, that's good and that's good, and we want the best of both. It's more complex than that, and it involves, again, to put it in a soundbite, expanding the scope of what people are able to value.
You suggested there are methods. You come to northeastern Pennsylvania and take part in the gathering. What kinds of things do you help us do, and what can we do for ourselves?
Well, this purview or perspective on culture, which tries to recognize all the major forms of culture, all the worldviews that are impacting and are, you know, composing American society, and being able to tease apart the dignities from the disasters of each of those worldviews so that we can more clearly see the positives of each, right? Like right now, people who are progressives usually only look at traditionals and see only the negatives, and vice versa. But there's positives there, so teasing those apart so that the positives can be more appreciated and distinguished from the more threatening parts. The next step of widening our perspective and broadening our values The next step involves values integration, which is a method or a political practice which we describe and advocate at the Institute for Cultural Evolution. And again, this can be distinguished from just admonishing people to try to meet in the middle or compromise for the greater good. Values integration means that in some ways you already value the values of their opponents. It's not a matter of trying to build a coalition or compromise or horse trade. It involves being able to metabolize or internalize opponents' values in a way that your position already, in a sense, is fortified and included by those values. So even though political interests may be permanently opposed or seemingly irreconcilable, at a deeper level of what you might call bedrock values, integration, or at least partial integration, becomes more possible. So the prime example of a successful program of values integration that moved politics forward was the recent success of gay marriage. I think that part of the reason that the issue of gay marriage helped advance gay rights overall was that gay marriage as an issue or as a proposition integrated values from across the spectrum, right? Even though, for example, traditionalists, many oppose and still oppose gay marriage, even though their interests weren't integrated into that program or position, their values were integrated nonetheless. In other words, the right to make a family commitment is something that flies in the face of arguments against, you know, sexual decadence, right? The basic right to make a family is a deep, deep traditional value. So the way this value was integrated, it made it difficult for those who saw their interests as opposed to gay marriage to argue against it. And so not only did gay marriage integrate progressive values, it also integrated libertarian freedom values as well as traditional values. So we can begin to see why this issue is so successful, not just legally, but now in its widespread social acceptance, because of the way it's carrying forward values from across the spectrum. And, you know, in our writing, we give other examples of issues that have been successful through this method, as well as other issues that now remain stuck, like global warming or immigration, because there's this deep cultural opposition because values aren't integrated and therefore identities are threatened. And so looking at the deeper level of bedrock values and working to integrate those at a level of values as opposed to the level of fractious political interests is an approach to cultural evolution, which we describe and advocate.
Now, does it take leaders in communities to begin conversations? How do we begin to get to the level beyond the fractiousness to the ability to integrate the values?
Well, this way of seeing, this perspective on the evolution of values and worldviews and culture is a new perspective, although there have been advocates of it. You know, we could point to Whitehead or Teilhard or any of the great philosophical masters of evolutionary philosophy of the 20th century, but there's some things about this view of the evolution of values that is new, that's taking form just now, and part of that is because we have a problem that's more urgent than ever before. You know, the divided electorate is a deeply problematic social condition which is focusing our attention on a society about a way to grope our way out of this wicked problem, right? So that's making the new truth of the way values and cultures evolve become more evident. So talking about it, investigating it, learning it, applying it, working with it, being hungry for this new truth, realizing that we need a wider perspective to overcome hyperpartisan polarization, that's where it begins. You know, it's a cultural solution to a cultural problem, and culture changes as people adopt new perspectives and those perspectives spread and form agreements. So we want to build agreement around the possibility of cultural evolution and even more around the techniques by which people can evolve their own values without changing their core identity or commitments. You know, again, we're trying to expand the scope rather than change where people's values lie. And there's a big difference, although subtle, between those two approaches.
And so often over the history of the world, it has been artists who maybe are picking up on trends. Do you get that sense that the arts play a role in this too?
Yeah, absolutely. In my books, I argue that if we want to make society better, if we want to work toward cultural maturation, this also involves a maturation of psychology or an evolution of consciousness. And if we look at history, the things which have evolved consciousness and resulted in changes, positive changes in society, have been the most intense expressions of that which is good, true, and beautiful, right? That is higher ideals of morality, wider conceptions of reality, and more subtle and meaningful aesthetic expressions are what move people, right? And that can literally move people's consciousness. So the arts have been a very important component in the emergence of new worldviews, and every historically significant worldview is accompanied by a kind of series of art movements which, you know, express at an emotional level the new truth, beauty, and goodness that goes with an emerging form of culture. So absolutely, the arts are critical, and in my investigation of these cultural renaissances, like I explained at the beginning, a focus on art and its role in cultural evolution has been a big part of my focus.
And so when you come to visit us for the gathering, these are the kinds of things that you'll be talking about with us?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm doing a keynote presentation on the Friday, I think it's the 14th, and that will be an overview of our view of culture at the Institute of Cultural Evolution, including a depiction of this method I described of values integration. Then in my workshop at the gathering on Saturday, the 15th at 3 p.m., I'll be going into some of the more, into the details about the methods or techniques, these sort of values technologies, if you will, that can help build political will and persuade people and overcome conflict and objections. And so we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty in my workshop.
You just see people throwing up their hands. What next?
Sure, sure. Well, and it's easy to succumb to pessimism, but I think that if we look at the history of the universe, if we take a long enough view, somehow something more keeps coming from something less. And, you know, while regression is always a possibility, I think that there's plenty of reasons for optimism, as I'll explain when I come to Pennsylvania.
Author Steve McIntosh, president of the Institute for Cultural Evolution, whose work explores the intersection of social development, spirituality, and politics. We had a chance to speak with him by phone about his presentation, Growing Out of America's Divided Culture, Reclaiming Solidarity Through a More Sophisticated Understanding of Progress, and his workshop, Participating in Political Evolution, at The Gathering, a symposium that lasts for 3 days each July at Keystone College in La Plume in Wyoming County, Friday, July 14th, Saturday, July 15th, and Sunday, July 16th. The theme of the gathering this year is finding the better angels of our nature, and the intent is to explore ways of finding common ground among bitter rivals, with an aim of finding ways to restore respect and acceptance among citizens and to reconnect with the best ideals of the country. As we said, the better angels of our nature. There will be other keynote addresses, there will be workshops, and much more as part of the 3 days. And for all the information you need, check the website, thegathering@keystone.org, thegathering@keystone.org. You're able to take a room for the entire 3 days on campus or to attend as a commuter. The details, as we say, are all at thegathering@keystone.org, thegathering@keystone.org. We heard today from author Steve McIntosh, president of the Institute for Cultural Evolution. He will speak on Friday, July 14th at 1:30 in the afternoon and offer his workshop Saturday, July 15th at 3, and that's titled Participating in Political Evolution. For listeners to NPR, you will recognize the keynote speaker, NPR's political affairs correspondent Mara Liasson, who will speak on Friday, July 14th at 7:30. Mara Liasson up from Washington to talk with us on Friday, July 14th at 7:30 p.m. as part of the gathering at Keystone College. The theme this year, finding the better angels of our nature. And for more information on the web, thegathering@keystone.org, thegathering@keystone.org.